Welcome to tonight's tale, a fairy tale theater podcast. We're your hosts. I'm Emily from Atlanta. I'm joined by my always beautiful co-host, Eric.
Hey, it's me. I'm Eric from New York.
And this week we are joined by our also beautiful friend, Leon. Hi, Leon.
Greetings and salutations. How's it going? Leon from Cleveland here.
Leon's been a friend of ours online for a very, very long time. So we're very happy that he's here to join us as we review, recap the episode, The Tale of the Frog Prince. Probably one of the most famous episodes of Fairy Tale Theater. The series premiere, as I recall. Eric, do you have the details on this one?
Yes, The Tale of the Frog Prince. It was the series premiere. It was the very first episode, the pilot episode of Fairy Tale Theater. It aired on September 11th, 1982.
And as I recall, it was written and directed by a very famous Monty Pythoner, the one and only Eric Idle, who also narrated the episode.
Yes, which I love because we love Monty Python and we love Eric Idle, of course.
We do. He's always been my personal favorite member of Monty Python, probably because of this episode.
He's great, but I did not know that he directed the episode until today. I thought that was pretty awesome.
Yeah, he directed it. He wrote it. He narrated it. All the above.
It's got his touches all around, doesn't it?
It really does. That script. Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. And of course, our Fairy Tale Theater fans will also know Eric Idle later starred as the Pied Piper of Hamelin. Anyways, Leon, I'm going to start with you. Before we do the recap, what is the very first thing that springs to mind when you think of the episode of The Frog Prince?
Like you already covered, I think that it's really special for being the first episode. I always think about that and the anecdote about how Shelley and Robin Williams, I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they came up with the idea for the whole show on the set of Popeye, right?
Yeah, in Malta.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, I did learn that somewhere in Malta. Yeah, I think of that. The production design, I feel like in the first three or four episodes, but the production design is really stylized, and I like that.
Oh, I completely agree. Eric, what's the first thing that jumps to your mind when you first think of The Tale of the Frog Prince?
I just love seeing one of these earlier works from Robin Williams. I think that's what makes it so special for me because Robin isn't here anymore. And I think has always been my favorite because I was always a huge fan of his. But I think now it's even more special because he isn't here anymore. We know about how the show pretty much started with the idea of Shelley and him on the set of Popeye just discussing fairy tales. She was, I think, took out a book during some of her breaks and she was reading fairy tales and just started gabbing to Robin about it. And, you know, I just think it's just so special because Robin's so special. So
he is, or was, sadly. Of course, we all miss him very much. And I'm with you guys. The very first thing that springs to mind when I think of this episode is Robin Williams. Not just because I grew up one town away from his hometown. I grew up in Birmingham, Michigan, same as him.
It always comes back to Michigan with Emily. Always. Yeah.
It always does. And then the other thing I think of when I first think of this episode is Eric Idle. And like I was saying, he's always been my personal favorite member of Monty Python. And this episode just has his touches all the way through it. His humor springs through. He directed it. He narrates it. And I had actually forgotten he narrated it. I remember that he wrote and directed it. But when I was doing my rewatch, I'm like, I absolutely forgot that he narrated it. So how familiar were you all with the original source material? I believe this is one that, as far back as we know, started with the Brothers Grimm.
I'm pretty familiar. I haven't read it in a while, but I'm pretty familiar. It's a rather short one, if I do remember that part about it.
Same for me. I know I've read it, but it's been a long time. Leon, I think you've read it more recently.
Yeah, I reread it the other day in preparation for the podcast. Yeah, I remember it. I read a lot of fairy tales growing up, especially the Grimm Brothers. And I remember, you know, the ending is different from many popular adaptations. And there's that weird thing with Iron Heinrich or whatever.
Yeah, Iron Heinrich. That was the one part of the fairy tale that never made sense to me.
It is so odd. Even and rereading it, I remembered it. And I thought maybe it had more of a function in the narrative. The prince and the princess don't even get a happily ever after, but Iron Heinrich is happy at the end, and I guess that's awesome. Yeah, I don't know.
It's like, well, we're glad random coachman's happy. As I recall, up until the climax, I remember this as being a very faithful adaptation.
It was pretty faithful, yeah, I think so. I mean, the climax being different is a big thing, because I remember I grew up with this version and actually a couple other ones. There was the Muppets one and the canon movie tales. Aww. And I had never realized that as a kid the first time reading it. I was like, damn, she just threw the thing against the wall.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, for a fairy tale from like 1815 or something like that.
Well, I also grew up with those versions, and Fairy Tale Theater was the one I knew most, but I also love the Muppet version and I love the canon version. We'll probably reference those as we go on.
Yeah, there's a lot to compare. And it's interesting that of the fairy tales that haven't been done by Disney, or at least not a direct adaptation, that The Frog Prince seems to be pretty popular for like making children's entertainment out of.
I love The Princess and the Frog, but it's not a strict adaptation.
I don't.
All right. You don't care.
I saw it once and it was cute.
So starting our recap, we start the episode with Shelley's introduction. Now, this is something I noticed. The introduction that I watched today is not the same version that I grew up with.
What?
Yeah, the version I watched today, it was Shelley wearing a wreath of flowers over her head with a black backdrop. And I vividly remember the version I watched that aired in probably 1982. And it was Shelley with straight hair, and she was on the set and she was wearing a tie. And I know for a fact she's given at least two different introductions for this episode. I noticed that right away.
Hello, I'm Shelley Duvall. Welcome to Fairy Tale Theater. For centuries, storytellers have spun their tales of magic and enchantment for the young at heart. Some of your favorite actors, writers, and directors have come together to bring these classic tales to your home. Some are funny, some are scary, and some romantic. So sit back, relax, and enjoy tonight's tale about a princess who finds happiness by keeping her promise to a frog, the Frog Prince.
So maybe she shot different ones for TV and then maybe reshot different ones for CBS Fox video releases. I don't know.
Just something funny I noticed. But anyways, moving along, our very first introduction to the episode, Eric Idle is our narrator. In our very first opening scene, we've got King Geoffrey and Queen Gwyneth talking about how they want a child. Just the staging of this, I found very funny, because clearly the man and the woman swapped sides from how you'd originally image that scene. Normally you think of the man being distant, looking out the window, and the woman looking forlorn. I just saw that Eric Idle just switched the blocking just because he could. Am I the only one that noticed that?
Yes, you are. Yeah, I did not notice that. No, but that is clever. Yeah, that is his type of thing, to do those little inversions of things.
Once you know Eric Idle and you know how many of his sketches he played the woman, it makes sense.
This basically is the opening scene of the story. You have, which I wrote in my notes, Kramer playing King Geoffrey, Michael Richards.
Not know that either. I think it might just be the prosthetic nose. But yeah, I had my boyfriend watch it the other day just to see what his opinion of it was, because he didn't grow up with the series. And he was like, oh my God, it's Kramer. And it's just that prosthetic nose. I had no idea.
Yeah. Okay. We've got Kramer playing the king, and Candy Clark is playing the queen.
Queen Gwyneth.
And she also later plays the lady-in-waiting Candy. We've got several actors playing multiple roles in this episode. We've got the king and queen discussing how they want to have a child, and they discuss trying witchcraft, and they reluctantly agreed to do it. We get our first good look at our witch in this episode, Griselda, a name that is all too often applied to witches. Even canon movie tales applied it to their witch in Hansel and Gretel.
Mm-hmm. And this is another dual role. She also plays Queen Beatrice.
Yeah,
Roberta Maxwell.
That blew my mind. Yeah, I did not know that until the credits ran the other night. I watched the show actually fairly often because it's just good, like, comfort food after like a stressful day at work. But I was sitting looking at the credits and I was like, oh my God, I had no idea that the Queen and Griselda are the same.
Yeah. And Roberta Maxwell, she was another one from Popeye. She was in Popeye as well.
But yeah, she plays Nana Oil in Popeye. Mm. For those of you that don't know, Olive Oil's Nana.
Griselda's a little bit fabulous, right? I vividly remembered her as a child. Are her hands crippled with arthritis? Because I noticed that for Griselda, but not for the scenes where she's playing the queen. Or is she just double jointed?
She's got prone hands. She's a witch.
I love the falling scene.
Me too.
You know, where they're standing over the cauldron with her and she's like making the potion. And it's so good.
They visited the old crone, who threw a number of foul smelling things into an old cauldron and stirred them and spat on them and muttered and chanted, and eventually made the good queen drink a little of it, which she was naturally very loath to do. But she wanted a baby very, very much, and so she swallowed it, and they thanked her and offered her some money.
There are so many double entendres in this episode, I lost count.
So there were a lot in the story, too, actually. Yeah, it's interesting. I think that's maybe one thing that he was deliberately carried over in the adaptation.
Really? I didn't remember that.
Just remember this. I am the child's godmother. Remember, you must invite me to the christening.
That sets up the next scene. And you have King Geoffrey and Queen Gwyneth getting ready for the christening party. And they're like running around.
I love it. It reminds me of all of my friends who are new parents who are trying to organize a party. Mm-hmm. They don't remember what their left hand did with their right hand. They are so confused. It was such a cute new parent scene. And I thought, oh dear, I can never remember his name. So I just wrote Kramer in my notes. But Kramer, I thought totally.
Geoffrey.
Yes, King Geoffrey. Thank you. He totally sold this scene. He's wondering if we've got all the lute players organized and tickets to the gallery. And he's checking the guest list and he notices someone's missing.
They've got those amazing felt crowns. I've just got to call out those felt crowns. I don't know if it's actually felt. It's some type of fabric, but I love them. And that was another thing that I remembered from childhood.
They look ridiculous, but I love them.
I love them, yeah.
And so, lo and behold, Griselda is not on the guest list. Now, I have a question. Why did Queen Gwyneth give him the guest list to look at moments before everyone's supposed to walk in? Like, what was that supposed to do?
I got a different question. How can you organize a christening and forget the godmother? I'm a godmother. That should be invitation number one. You don't forget the godmother at a christening. I'm sorry. I am Team Geoffrey on this argument. She's like, I just had a baby. I don't know where my mind is.
I've been busy.
And don't forget, she sat Geoffrey next to the boring queen that only likes to talk about trout.
About trout. Yeah. Yeah. That line always stands out. Like, I just
another
can't imagine having a
fishy conversation.
That was such an Eric Idle moment.
Yes.
Do I have to sit next to that boring old queen? I'm totally Team Geoffrey here because he remembers who his son's godmother is. His wife doesn't.
See, my take on it on this viewing was, this is maybe just me being too much of a fairy tale nerd, but I think it was a tribute to, you know, the beginning of the Sleeping Beauty ballet where they're going over the guest list at like the very last minute.
Oh.
And then Carabas comes in and like humiliates the dude pulling his wig off and stuff. It made me think of that. I was wondering if maybe that was inspiration.
I had not made that connection. That's a good call, Leon. I had not thought of that.
That just occurred to me last night. It's just like I was paying a lot of attention to how Eric Idle had added this, not a frame story, but the backstory. And I just love the way that he did it. It's a really good adaptation.
No, but you're right. As I recall in the original Frog Prince, I don't think we really got a clear explanation as to why he was turned into a frog. And I think this story is, I think you're right, borrowed from Sleeping Beauty. I had not made that connection before.
Yeah, I just noticed that last night, and you're 100% right about the story. The story was pretty much just like, oh, it was a wicked witch, and they don't say anything else about it. But
same as Beauty and the Beast.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, wasn't that my parents didn't believe in fairies?
Yeah.
Yeah. But I really like that with this frame story, they were also able to kind of work in the moral. But we'll get to that in a minute here.
So after Geoffrey realizes that they forgot to invite Griselda,
the godmother.
Geoffrey is also the fairy godmother, who also happens to be a very powerful witch with really powerful magic that got your wife pregnant right away. He's like, oh crap, lock the gates. He's very smart.
Credit. He tries. He really tries. He actually tries to call the whole thing off and reschedule. And she shows up and too little, too late, bro.
Too late. She freezes the guards. I love that effect with the guards. Yeah. Where she freezes them and you see their skeleton with the flash of light.
Oh, I never noticed that. I just saw the puff. Ooh. Mm-hmm.
And Jeffrey.
Which also, by the way, is connected to when Maleficent walks in Sleeping Beauty, where everyone freezes.
More Sleeping Beauty?
Mine.
Yeah, more Sleeping Beauty.
Alone.
It's a very similar scene, by the way.
Yeah. In the ballet as well. Yeah.
Down to the animation. You're right.
Mm, so good.
Hello, godmother. Did you get the invitation? No. Damn. It's a clerical error. Actually, the post has been just awful recently. You really can't trust it.
King of backpedaling here. Damn. So unreliable. I mean, good for him. He does his very best to save it, but Griselda utters the famous words,
"A promise is a promise!"
Which I think is probably the main theme of this fairy tale. And if you watch Canon Frog Prince, they've got a whole song called "A Promise."
Take a drink every time they say it.
But I think that is the ultimate lesson of this fairy tale, because you do hear several times, a promise is a promise. And Griselda gets her revenge. Of course, she takes it out on the baby. I would have taken it out on the queen, but that's me.
Yeah.
Yeah, she points her finger and a puff of smoke and the lights go out. And then when the smoke all dissipates and the lights, you know, you're able to see everyone again. You just see Queen Gwyneth and she's looking into the crib.
What is it, Gwyneth?
My child!
And then she screams and she faints, and that's the exposition. Yeah. I love that the opening credits start and they used Mozart's Piano Concerto number 21. I thought that was very cool.
Oh, I love that. Ooh. One of my favorite pieces by Mozart.
I wasn't aware of that. Usually I'm the one pointing out the classical music references. That's cool.
Yeah, I agree. And the artwork, this was when I really had an appreciation for Maxfield Parrish's artwork.
Yeah, it's very striking.
It is, and it's just a very beautiful interpretation. I've seen a couple pieces of his work in person. There's a gorgeous piece of his in Rochester that I saw, and a beautiful mural in New York City. Old King Cole, I think it's called. Eric, I sent you pictures of it.
Yeah, you went to Old King Cole's bar and you saw the mural there, which is a historic mural.
And pretty much most of the costumes were based on that mural. It's stunning. So the opening sequence alone just gave me a new appreciation for the art design, the set design, the costumes.
I'm definitely going to have to check that mural out, but they really did jump out at me again on this rewatch.
Yeah, I forgot how beautiful the art direction was.
Yeah, even with some of the scenes with like the weird blue screen effects and stuff, I love it. I find it very, very charming.
Agreed. Our first scene after the opening credits is our beautiful René Auberjonois playing King Ulrich. And this is his first appearance in fairy tale theater. Of course, we see him later as another king. He played the king in Sleeping Beauty. And he's joined by Roberta Maxwell, this time playing Queen Beatrice. So they introduce the birth of the princess here.
It's just a quick little scene. You're just showing them with the princess. And then the narrator, Eric Idle, tells us that the princess grew up to be very, very beautiful, but very, very, very vain and spoiled beyond belief.
And it is a cut to one of my favorite scenes, not just in the episode, but in all of fairy tale theater. We've got the beautiful Terry Garr owning this scene. She is spending all her time admiring herself in the mirror, and she's ordering all of her servants to give her the proper angle. And she is 120% committed to this character. I so much forgot how much fun Terry Garr is in this episode.
I want to be queen. Why should I marry a prince? I'm already a princess. Tell him I won't come to his ball.
Yes, my lady.
And it's great fun to watch, too. Yeah, she played the same princess, if I'm not mistaken, in Once Upon a Brothers Grimm, right?
Yes, the princess and the frog prince, yeah.
Yeah, with the croquet mallet, yeah.
Are we talking Grimm Party, or am I confused?
No. Once Upon a Brothers Grimm, it was like a made-for-TV musical. It was like the Brothers Grimm countering characters from their story.
How do I not know about this?
What? It's oh, man. Okay, well, yeah, you're going to have to check that out, and I guess I'll have to check
out Popeye. How do I not know about this?
I don't know. Yeah, Terry Garr also plays the Frog Prince princess in that movie.
Oh, my God. I love
it. Yeah, this show was on in like 1977. It was an old made-for-TV movie. It was on in 1977. Yeah, Terry Garr is the princess and the frog prince, and she's wearing a green lily pad dress that is very much ripped off for the Princess and the Frog.
Oh, you're right.
You know what?
It's her final gown, and they ripped it off 100%.
Wow.
Very, very, very faint memory, but I bow down to you boys. You called it.
I'm sure you cheated before.
Well, anyways, we do have Terry giving a beautiful performance here. I actually wrote down, and I mean, I'm sorry, this will probably be a controversial comment. I thought Terry was funnier than Robin Williams here. I thought she was 120% committed.
Yeah, she's pretty phenomenal. I just saw today she won some type of award for the role, but I don't know what kind of award.
We do see the bumbling page come in, who's just delightful. And
really?
Oh, I love this whole exchange where
your majesty, her queen, no, that's not for me. You can have that one.
Lesson on how to explain the message. It's not so much him, it's Terry. It is Terry commanding this scene. Yes. Make no mistake, yes. Terry is the princess, and we all bow down. So,
excuse me, princess.
I will not mention which British princess this reminds me of. So the page does...
Meghan Markle, moving on.
So the page does bring up the fact that apparently her parents and their guests have been waiting over an hour in the Rose Garden for her to turn up. But apparently she's been, you know, preoccupied looking at herself in the mirror, as one does.
And I really like Charlie Dell, who plays the page.
Oh, he's really good. He's very committed.
He's been in three other Fairy Tale Theater episodes as well.
Yes.
Ooh, he was in The Nightingale. He was in Princess and the Pea, and he was also in Cinderella.
Oh.
He played the page in Princess and the Pea, right? The poor guy that held the book.
The
poor, poor man who held the book, the Royal Book of Prayer.
Yeah.
And he was in Cinderella. He was part of Arturo and his...
Oh, Band of Merry Cellists. Is that what it was?
Merry Cellists. Yes.
Yeah.
See, so good. Remember him.
Love him.
Oh, God bless him.
So good.
So the princess is trying to get out of... Well, not even trying to get out of. She's just not interested in going to spend an evening with her parents and their friends. And they're like, well, Prince Howell might be there. This is the first time we hear mention of Prince Howell, the off-screen character.
Them brought that miserable creep Prince Howell with them, have they?
Miserable Prince... Oh, no, m'lady.
Thank God for that. He's such a macho meat face. He's always out skewering dragons or something, massacring them. Whatever makes them think that I would want to marry a man whose only pleasure is murdering large, scaly, fire-breathing animals, huh?
He's such a macho meat face.
Terry was trying to get out of going to this tea party until she finds out they brought her a gift.
Oh, a gift.
A gift.
A gift, you say?
And that's when she decides she will go to the party as soon as she's done looking at herself in the mirror.
Even though Hal has a good body.
I definitely wrote that quote down. Yeah, that's great. Every time, that makes me smile.
That was candy.
He's quite handsome, my lady. He has the brains of a shrimp. He's got a good body. Will you be quiet?
As a feminist, I'm a little torn, like, whose side I'm supposed to be on.
I'm on Candy's side.
I'm definitely on, I'm on Candy's side.
He's got a good part. I'm divided.
You gotta go down to at least check him out. Your hair will be there, you know, in a couple hours.
Good. That's good. At least go down there and check him out. I'm with you on that, Leon.
We'll see if Candy's right about his body.
Yeah. Well, our princess does go down and she does meet the family. And as King Geoffrey says, she's very beautiful. And as Queen Gwyneth says, very late.
Yeah, she's not amused.
Prince Hal is not there because apparently he got a last minute word of dragon activity outside the realm that he had to go
with
take
the boy,
which
on
is
on brand.
Yep. It's not impressing the princess at all.
Well, I read in a book recently that dragons are in danger of becoming extinct through all of this horrid hunting, you know?
Daughter!
You see, I think they should be preserved. They seem like rather nice creatures compared to adolescent princes with homicidal tendencies.
That is my favorite line in the episode.
Really? That is pretty good. And this is the part where I notice, and I've never seen this before, but these little interactions between Queen Gwyneth and Terry Garr, and that just made me howl. That was pretty good. She's just looking at her like...
just bitch.
Yeah, like there's just like, it's a very brief little cutaway, but she's just like shooting daggers at her with her eyes. Pretty
evil,
great.
Evil eye, yeah.
Yeah.
Cutting. The word we girls use is cutting.
Cutting.
But they still did bring a gift, so they open it, and it's a beautiful gold ball.
You're forgetting that queen, Beatrice? The other queen, that's not Gwyneth, Beatrice. I still think this gag is funny. I remember this from childhood, where they present her with the box.
A box? Oh, how lovely. Isn't it a beautiful box, Ulrich? Oh, how very thoughtful. Thank you so much.
It's not just the box.
What?
I don't know why, but that makes me laugh every single time.
Okay, the reason I skipped it is because I cracked this joke every Christmas for about 10 years.
That's a good one. That's a good one. I'll have to quote
absolutely
that.
True.
Oh, what a lovely box.
Every time.
But there's something inside the box. Oh, a box and something inside it.
Absolutely true. Ask my siblings, ask my parents. Yeah, I'm sorry to say, I cracked this joke for 10 years, so I was kind of hoping I could skip over it.
No, I'm not going to let it be skipped over. I love it. It's too good.
Well, what happens when you grow up on fairy tale theater?
Yeah, I love that when the ball levitates up, you can see the steam on the ball. I unironically love that. I think that's another bit of charm.
Love that? That's a part that irritated me to no end. Make it more obvious that it's a beach ball spray tan. Spray paint.
Spray paint.
No, Emily. It was 100% one of those balls that you would go to the supermarket when you were a kid. It was in one of those big giant, those big rubber balls. You know what I'm talking about?
The supermarket, the ball,
and they're in those big giant like container in the supermarket.
Ball pits in the 80s. You're right.
Yeah,
it's definitely one of those that they spray painted with gold.
Yeah. You could still see the name. That's the part that irritated the heck out of me, and it irritated the heck out of me as a kid. I'm like, I can see the seam. A pure gold ball would not have a seam like that.
That might have bothered me as a kid, but nowadays I'm just like, that's cute.
No, it still bothers me.
But I love when it comes out of the box. I love the pop and the pop of light and then the glitter everywhere. Oh, it's so camp, so 80s, so good.
It's a good special effect, except for the stupid seam. Although I do like the line, is it magical? We're not sure.
Well, we're not sure. Yeah, that's...
I love that it's like covering
the table.
I love that it's hovering and you could see the string holding it. Well, it's quote unquote hovering.
Is it magical? Yeah. It's flying over your head. What do you think? Well, we're not sure. I love that. But the princess instantly falls in love with the ball. And yes, I'm aware of just how that sounded. This is the episode full of double entendres. I can't.
And I like the theme that it was a gift from their son's fairy godmother.
Yes.
Like they kept their promise and so they got rewarded instead of punished.
That's exactly it. It was a gift from Hal's fairy godmother. So they learned their lesson. It is a little symbolic. You're right. That is kind of a throwaway line, but it does make some sense. Okay.
Yeah, I think that's there for a reason.
They appointed her godmother of their second son, probably hoping they'd fix the first one, but no, they got a gold ball out of the deal.
There's something poetic, though, about, I mean, everybody knows the ending. It's not a spoiler, but in this adaptation, that like the moral of the story is keeping your promise. And I'm wondering if there was any thought into the prince is cursed until somebody else keeps an unlikely promise to him. I mean, there's something possibly poetic about that, even though it's.
That's I'm going to ask you to put a pin in that.
Okay.
But that's a good thought. Our next scene is the king and queen and princess waving goodbye as the other royal family departs. And the princess said she'd rather have that golden ball any day than a dragon mugger. Our next scene is straight out of a Maxfield Parrish painting. It reminds me of the one that I know is housed at Memorial Art Gallery in Rochester. It's called Interlude. And
is that the woman with toga in the forest?
It's the minstrels. I think it might even be cherubs, but I saw this painting and I went, this is straight out of Frog Prince, because guess which one I saw first. This entire scene was cut out of the version I grew up with. It was completely cut. I didn't see this entire scene until I was in my 20s.
Wow.
And I must say, I didn't miss anything by it being. It's a pretty unnecessary scene, in my opinion. We got a snarky minstrel.
Well, I love beauty like the rose must very soon decay. So good. And fun fact about him, his name is Van Dyke Parks. And guess where he's from?
I know that name.
I know that name too, but I can't place it.
Popeye.
Of course.
Whatever.
He plays Hoagie the piano player in Popeye.
That would make sense.
Now it all makes sense.
And he's also from Twin Peaks. He's in a lot of things. And he's also in Mother Goose Rockin' Rhyme. He comes back for Master of Merriment.
In other words, he's one of Shelley's friends.
Yeah, right.
And he's actually a songwriter. He wrote a lot of songs.
Oh,
he wrote a lot of songs and arranged a lot of songs.
I guarantee you he wrote this little ditty. But it's a cute little scene. I mean, he plays a snarky minstrel. But
I love it.
I enjoy it, but I never saw it until I was older, and I can't say I missed anything by that scene being cut. I mean,
stereo, that'll never catch on.
The Bobbsey twins. I think, if anything, the only reason to keep it in is really backdrop of like the enchanted looking tree branches.
Well, that's it. I thought the art direction, as soon as I did see it and I could place the painting it was based on, I loved it. And when I did see it, I'm like, well, that's a cute scene, but it really didn't add anything to the story.
Yeah.
It's, the princess is still bitchy. Moving on. Our next scene, we have the introduction of our frog prince. We've got Robin Williams sitting on top of a well, and Terry Garr comes in singing off key, which I presume intentionally.
I didn't notice that.
Oh, how could you miss that?
Oh, yeah, the beauty, like, yeah, you're right, yeah.
And
she hates the minstrel, but she's singing his song.
Yep.
Really? Actually, can't deny that.
So we get our first famous interaction between our frog and our princess.
La, 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 la.
Pardon me. Could you not make so much noise? You're scaring away all the flies.
Who said that?
I did.
Where are you?
I'm over here.
I don't see you.
I'm on top of the well, dear.
Oh, a horrid toad.
Ooh, a nasty princess. And I am not a toad. I am a frog and fiercely proud of it.
I think this is the sharpest written exchange in the episode. The dialogue is very clipped. It's very fast. It's very intelligent. And
it's reminiscent of old Hollywood movies where the guy and the girl don't get along at the beginning and they bicker and blah, 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 and then the tension builds and they end up lovers.
You're right. It's almost like 30s screwball comedy, how fast that dialogue moves. I hadn't put that connection together, but I think you're absolutely right.
I mean, they have great chemistry too, to be able to pull that off in such a short scene.
And you can tell thanks to the cheesy 80s effects, you can tell they aren't actually in the same room at the same time, but those two delivered those lines so fast.
They really did. I was watching that same thing about just thinking about how he's superimposed in the frame. And it was just very entertaining to watch that energy level, just knowing that they're not even necessarily even on set at the same time.
I think the cheesy 80s effects made me appreciate this more because that's how fast they delivered the dialogue, how clever it was. And I appreciated it more if he'd been life size and standing next to her. I mean, it would have worked as well, too. But I think the fact that you could just tell they were not actually looking at each other, and they could still do a William Powell, Carol Lombard, a Myrna Loy. They could still Dean Harlow, the screwball of the 30s. It was that fast, that funny, that sexual innuendos. You're right. It was 30s screwball. And I just loved absolutely every moment of this scene. It's probably the scene of not even this episode, but fairy tale theater in general. It's kind of the scene. That's a bold statement, I know.
Oh, a cat may look at a king, so a frog may certainly look at a princess.
Frogs shouldn't mix with society.
Oh, one person can hardly be called a society.
Can be.
Oh, cannot. A society is more than one person. It is a collective noun. Several people.
Look, there's no need to show off.
Oh, well, hoity-toity now. Me showing off? You come here disturbing the peace of the afternoon, scaring away my lunch, and massacring the language and accuse me of showing off. La-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da.
Well, you shouldn't be here.
The thing that you said about, were you implying that the size difference would have made it different if they were on set together?
Because that's something. Not that it was something that was ever going to happen. I just think it gave everyone an appreciation because those bad special effects actually gave us an appreciation of how gifted the performers were, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I also read, in preparation, I read a little bit in Bruno Bettelheim's Uses of Enchantment about Frog Prince, and it was a whole bunch of Freudian psychosexual mumbo jumbo, but he did point out that in this animal groom cycle, as he calls this story a part of, that compared to Beauty and the Beast and all of the other ones, that a frog is deliberately not as threatening as a monster or a beast or whatever. I thought that was interesting.
I could see that. Getting back to the dialogue that I think everyone agrees is probably the quickest and sharpest, at least in this episode. We've got the great Robin Williams making his debut, and he's got so many great lines here. I love how defensive he is about being a frog. He's not embarrassed to be a frog. He will tell you he is a frog and fiercely proud of it.
It's so good. And basically what happens after that, after their little back and forth,
the princess,
me, I dig on you kind of thing, she drops that ball, that rubber ball. Sorry, golden ball.
That pure magical golden ball that looks like a beach ball.
If it's gold, it's hollow because it's got that scene.
Anyways, the princess drops her ball down the well and she strikes up a deal with the frog. The frog offers to go and get it, but he's got his list of conditions. The innuendos go on and on and on here. My favorite is, after dinner, I'd like to sleep with you.
I've turned down crown heads. You think I'm going to shack up with a frog?
Yes.
That went right over my head when I was a kid. I'm going to shack up with a frog.
I've turned down crown heads. You think I'm going to shack up with a frog?
This right here is what made fairy tale theater so brilliant, because it's not like I was offended as a kid. I had no idea what the heck they were talking about.
No, absolutely.
Hilarious. And I don't even remember asking my mom what she meant. It was so far over my head. I'm like, she doesn't want him near her pillow. That's what she meant.
Like I said, though,
it's very fast. So that's probably why also you wouldn't get it as a kid because everybody changes her so fast.
That's true too.
So I love when the princess is actually pondering this. She's like, okay, what is he going to do? Storm the castle. Let's just do it. Let's just tell him we'll do it. And then we'll run away. That sounds like a good plan.
Logical argument. I mean, what's one frog going to do?
And so she does it. She goes, you got yourself a deal, Froggy. So he does it. He jumps down there. Oh, and it's such a cute scene.
Oh, you are skipping the most important part.
Oh, God.
Things, a song.
It goes on for so long. Oh, not the song.
I got a friend, a brand new friend.
Couldn't we just skip the song?
No, the song goes with it.
Someone on whom I can depend. With a princess for a pal, everyone will call me Al.
Why Al?
It's a rhyme, go with it.
She'll feed me food and serve me drink, and when she has washed me in her sink, upon her bed in froggy bliss, upon my lips she'll lay a kiss, and I won't snore or make a mess beside my wonderful princess.
Nice song.
Ugh, I hate the song.
I'm glad you agree with me. I was not glad of that.
Oh no, there were other parts of this episode I could have just fast-forwarded through, but...
It could have been one verse.
Well, I think it was two verses. It wasn't that bad, but...
If it was two verses, those felt like really long verses.
Well, if you remember, what's Eric Idle most famous for on Monty Python? The silly songs. He wrote the Lumberjack song.
Lumberjack,
he wrote Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. He had to put a song in there. He had to.
Well, I'm not mad about it. I don't care for it. Not that I don't care for it. It just goes on too long in my... It feels like it does.
Anyways, after we get the song that I liked and apparently the boys didn't, the frog does jump into the well and...
I love this scene because when he jumps down the well, you have the very campy Terry Gar just... showing her head popping out from the top of the well. So you have the view, the camera looking up the well.
I wrote that down too, that particular matte painting. And I think that is one of those things that's characteristic of those first few episodes. It's just like the find solutions for maybe not having as much budget as later ones. I don't know if that's necessary.
Right. Actually, I'm the one with the dirty mind because I wrote down,
Yeah, no, it's definitely there in the story too. There was code, and I don't know, you know, well, yeah.
So that's where my mind went, but pray continue.
Yeah, no, I think it's very intentional. I think that this
is Froggy. Ooh, Froggy, be careful with my ball. I mean, be careful with yourself.
Right.
Of course, before he goes into the well, she smacks his butt and he falls down into the well. Like, he doesn't jump down. She smacks his butt and he goes falling down.
There's nothing unintentional when it comes to a Monty Python member.
Monty Python writing a fairy tale. No. The humor is a little bit more mature, but not just... There's mature humor in the other ones, but in this one, it's a little bit more sophisticatedly mature, if that makes any sense.
Sophisticated in some ways, unsophisticated in others.
Oh, crap.
So, and then you have the ball coming up out of the well, and it's like the sun rising, and it's like
2001. Yeah. Also, Frost of Zarathustra. Yeah.
Da-da. It's so good. And she grabs the ball, and she's like, sucker. And she just runs away. And he comes up. He's like, princess, where are you, princess? And he's like, I'm so tired. And she's not there. She bounced.
He realizes he's been ditched.
He's been got. He got got. We cut right to the next scene,
Well said. It happens to the best of us. Well said.
It happens. It happens to the best of us. Although I've never heard that before.
No, but we've all had that moment where we realize we've been had. So
And in the following scene, we have the grandfather clock.
I love this guy. I made a note of him earlier.
But I have a question.
Okay.
Isn't the grandfather clock, isn't he also in the beginning scene in King Jeffrey's castle? So do they share the same clock?
No, at the beginning. It's the same grandfather clock. I just figured they had
Oh my God. I didn't even realize that.
Quadruplets, and their whole job was to keep perfect time.
Wow.
Oh yeah, they all had the same grandfather clock. I loved it.
Yeah,
time is 11:30 precisely.
Yeah. Gosh, do you know how perfect it would have been if they kept the same guy doing that in every single episode.
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah.
I love it.
Still went over my head. I can only surmise that he's some type of interdimensional cosmic entity.
I love that.
I love that. It's so fairy tale theater, so camp, so perfect, so good.
Oh, Shelley.
Yeah, I love it.
You just blew my mind with that one.
After our grandfather clock, we move into the banquet hall.
Yes. And of course, we have our lovely Donovan Scott coming back again, who was also in Goldilocks and the Three Bears. He's Cubby. And who's also part of this lovely party in the Frog Prince episode of
also
Popeye characters. Every one of this episode's from Popeye. Castor Oil, Olive Oil's brother.
Yes, exactly.
Castor Oil. Oh my God.
Yeah.
And he's another one that plays two characters. Because he plays the Major Domo. I'm not sure if he has a name. And then he also plays the chef.
Yeah, my VHS. All right. Hendrix the show. Okay. Yeah. I think
Hendrix is his name.
Major Domo.
Okay.
His name is Hendrix, and he's also the French chef. The French chef has no name, but Hendrix is the name of Major Domo. So,
I just
that's super cool.
So.
That is cool. I like that they have names.
But I didn't ever catch that they were played by the same person. They're so different as characters in the story, the accent and the cadence and the costume and everything is so different. I never caught it until just recently. So,
you know what? This is actually something worth pausing about. I knew or noticed that some of the actors had dual roles, but it took me a long, long time to realize just how many had dual roles. I remember recognizing Andy had two roles. I remember recognizing Griselda was Beatrice, I think just by reading the credits, but
that's because it's one of the first credits. Yeah, that fucked me up. Yeah.
But I never quite realized just how many actors had two roles. I think that's a new level of appreciation. Maybe I knew back in the day, but I forgot. I don't know. But this is kind of genius of Eric Idle casting and directing, because like Donovan Scott.
Well, it gives like a sense of consistency through the episode. But yeah, I feel like it adds a little bit of consistency that even though there's multiple characters on some level familiar.
The condition of the stage, like Captain Hook and Mr. Darling. That's how I view it. It seemed more like a theatrical production that way.
Interesting. Okay.
I mean, we have later episodes like Sleeping Beauty and Rapunzel that have dual roles, but I don't think ever this many. It's maybe two characters. I love that there's a frog out there. So that's what our friend Hendrix comes in and says to the king. And the frog did show up. And so the princess now tells the story of the frog.
I love the princess's reaction.
Did you invite a frog to dinner, darling? Oh, a frog! A frog! Was that tonight? Oh, boy. Ooh. Yes, I did.
Yeah, I like that announcer that just gives all the gossip right as the banquet's still going on.
I just love how that was delivered. I love that.
Yeah, it's just amazing.
And then the scene after, we have the chef, the French chef, and that's once again played by Donovan Scott. So we have two scenes back-to-back played by Donovan Scott, and he's... it's so good. It's so good.
It's good, but...
I just thought it was so long. Y'all thought the song went on too long. I thought the scene with Donovan Scott, as much as I love you, Donovan, I thought that scene went way, way, way too long. We know that the frog doesn't realize that the chef is trying to cook him for dinner. That went on and on and on.
It has that little bit of shtick too, where it's like, wait, why? The one that always comes to my mind is Le Boisson, you know, like the Little Mermaid shit, you know?
Oh, yeah, they definitely had inspiration by this scene for the Little Mermaid, 100%.
And Renee Auberjonois was the chef, right?
Exactly. The voice of Chef Louis in Little Mermaid was Renee Auberjonois, who played the king in this episode. So.
Yep. Yeah, there's no way that's coincidental.
It's exactly almost the same scene with Le Poisson because it's like literally
character.
It's the same concept. Sebastian is getting, they're trying to cook him. They're trying to make him into a stuffed crab. And the French chef is trying to make the frog into frog's legs for dinner. In the VHS version of this, I did notice this because I bought the DVD. Yeah, because I had the CBS Fox, I have the original CBS Fox VHS tape of this episode. I went back and watched the VHS because when I bought this DVD set, which is what I used to do my rewatch for this episode, right, they cut back and forth between the banquet hall and the French chef. Whereas in the VHS tape, they're very extended scenes that are separate. There's no cutting back and forth, which is better. It's better for viewing.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Which one you're saying, that the VHS one is better?
Yes, because there's no cutting back and forth like in the DVD.
I was confused on this viewing because it cut back and forth more than I thought it did. And it was while I was making my notes, I was expected to make notes about the scene, but it kept being intercut. And I was like, wait, what's going on? This isn't necessarily the version I remember. Because
the original version doesn't do that.
I'm exactly in the same boat because it kept cutting and cutting. And I'm going, this isn't how I remember it.
Yeah.
The frog does escape near death thanks to a very prolonged sequence that went on far too long. And the frog is delivered to the banquet hall. He's put on the table.
Before that, though.
Okay.
Before he's delivered to the banquet hall, there's a whole scene with the princess where she says that she's not going to keep her end of the promise.
Beautiful sequence. And it's with Rene Auberjonois playing the
monologue.
And he's
by the fireside.
His daughter a serious talking to, which, let's all face it, she needs. And he gives her some real truths. And it seems very serious until the camera pulls back and you realize the whole court is listening.
I noticed that camera work too. That was, most of the other shots are very static and that's moving around them. And it looks very intimate because of the lighting by the fireside. And they're like right over the same day.
Everyone in the kingdom is witness to that. But
all the way from the top, that's me. He goes, I'll look at the way.
Jack the Looney who adapted the zombies.
Yeah.
It's a really, really pivotal scene.
It's actually a brilliant scene. I mean, aside from the obvious comedic camera work that was made for a laugh, what the king actually says to the princess is very true.
Real shit.
Yeah, it's very true. It's don't take everything for granted. Okay, you've been granted this great life of privilege and you cannot take it for granted. You need to be appreciative and you need to respect everyone from me down to Jack the Looney who looks after
Jack the Looney.
Because there's an order and a structure for everything in this world. It's basically like the whole message he gives to her. You know, you're you, but everyone else is still important.
That's like the moralistic part of the episode.
So I guess there's two real points to this episode. One is keep a promise, and another is respect everyone if they're above you or below you in station.
And then, of course, the frog gets brought in. For me, Emily, this scene is very long. It does not need to be this long. It's a little ridiculous.
The frog
is doing magic tricks and he's juggling and he's dancing and he's
like a fireplace poker, like a curtain rod or something. And it really goes on. You know, I remembered it being more painful than it was on this viewing. On this viewing, I found some of the other shtick a little bit more difficult to sit through, but it was edited fairly well as far as I remembered. I remembered cringing for it more so.
Leon, I'm the complete opposite. I remember this sequence being hysterical. I remembered it being Robin Williams doing stand-up. And then I watched
going,
he had like 3 good jokes. The rest were frog puns. And
I wonder how much of it was ad-libbed and how much of it was the Eric Idle script on this viewing.
I don't think he...
I think it was probably largely ad-libbed with a lot of...
I don't think there were many ad-libs and I don't think there was much in the script. I think it was more just... Actually, I'd say my guess is most of it was scripted. This was still Robin Williams in the height of his Mork and Mindy days.
The Mork and Mindy and like a whole bunch of cocaine. And it was.
I can believe.
Put the camera on him and let him go.
My guess is a lot of his jokes got cut out for children audiences. That's my honest.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if Eric Idle was like, this is a part where you're just going to tell some jokes, you know, pretend like you're roasting the king and queen. Oh, just do that.
Robin Williams really uncorked it and none of it made it into the cut. That's just my guess. Instead, we got Robin Williams doing a tightrope act on a curtain rod. And
it's also a little bit, though, I'm sure like he was given the direction to improv, but keep it family friendly. Yeah.
But I agree with you guys. This sequence was not nearly as funny as I remembered it. It actually seemed extended, long, boring.
It was. I didn't remember it. He had those limitations of it being a family program, and I'm sure that has something to do with.
We finished the dinner, and the king, who has made his position clear, the princess tries to get out of it by going to bed, but the king reminds her that she's got a bunkmate tonight.
And she's thrilled.
Very slightly.
Yes, right. Bring that thing.
This leads us right into the bedroom scene where the frog is brought into the princess's chambers and she's getting ready for bed. She's putting on her lotions and the chambermaids, the ladies in waiting, whatever you want to call them, they're helping her get ready for bed. They're changing her and she's changing into her nightgown. And the frog is in the little wash basin taking a bath.
He's having the most enjoyable bubble bath. I wish I could have that enjoyable of a bubble.
He's really, having fun with that. Oh, it's great, yeah.
And whether the froggy would like it or not, it simply have to blow.
Turn around, you horny toad.
Sorry, I've just never seen a set of stems like that before. Oh, thigh, thigh.
Yeah,
and he's blowing the bubbles everywhere, and he's just having the best time. He loves it.
He's singing. He's in it. My takeaway is I need to learn to enjoy my bubble baths that much.
That's a good takeaway.
He's living his best life. I just love it. And then he dries himself off and he says to her, and I love this line. He's like,
you're beautiful in your own bitchy way.
And I'm like, I'm a woman. And I go, as a very openly over-opinionated woman, someone calling me, you're very beautiful in your own bitchy way.
That's a compliment.
Thank you.
And she's just looking at him.
Thank you right off the bat. Oh, she was willing to accept that one. Damn. Okay.
It's me. I'm not Terry Garr, but that's me.
Terry Garr is just looking at him.
Oh, no. She's staring daggers at him throughout this entire scene.
And then I love that in the next scene, we're moving on to the bed and he's being brought to the bed. And I'm thinking about earlier.
I'm sorry, Eric, you are skipping a very important moment because this is where I said this is completely true to the original Grimm Brothers story. Leon, correct me if I'm wrong here, but she threatens to throw him out a window.
Out the window. And that was, and I never noticed it before, even like, on my roof. Yeah, no, that is a very deliberate reference.
The real departure happened because if you ask my 7-year-old niece what happens at the end of The Frog Prince, she'll tell you the princess kisses the frog and he turns into a prince. Those of us who have read the Brothers Grimm story remember a little differently, and I think this is the scene that pays tribute to that. So yes, they do still do the kiss, but they still pay tribute to the way the original Grimm Brothers story goes.
It makes absolute sense. I hadn't noticed that in the Fairy Tale Theater episode until I reread the story, but it was something, actually not something, like it was when she had lain down to sleep, he came creeping up saying, I am tired and want to sleep as much as you. Take me up or I will tell your father. Then she felt beside herself with rage, and picking him up, she threw him with all her strength against the wall, crying, now you'll be quiet, you horrid frog.
I am one with the princess here, because I do remember her throwing the frog against the
wall. And then as he fell, he ceased to be a frog and became all at once a prince with beautiful, kind eyes. And so the frog is insistent that, I guess, she didn't keep the promise, but slams it up against the wall trying to fucking kill it, and it turns into a prince, and so she she's rewarded for nothing and she hasn't learned a lesson.
Or maybe she got rewarded for calling him out.
Yeah, I could see that being a takeaway.
It's a very obscure lesson that's in that original fairy tale. I'll admit I never quite got where they were going with it. I understand why the traditional is she kisses him and he turns into a prince, but that's basically the modern Beauty and the Beast element, I think. The German version of Frog Prince, it sure isn't he's a prince underneath all that slime. It's
No, he's not, because it says like all at once he's being a frog and became the prince. And
it's like she's rewarded for calling him out. I mean, you could make an argument for a very feminist fairy tale.
Yeah, actually you could. I honestly never thought about it that way. I always thought it was weird because it gets derailed by the Iron Heinrich at the end, but yeah.
The story ends with the princess, well, the way I'm choosing to interpret it now, she stands up for herself and throws him against the wall. He turns into a prince and takes her as his wife off to his castle.
With the father's consent.
It's his servant, Iron Heinrich, and his heart is kept in iron or something.
Yeah, I'm going to apply even a queer reading to this. There is something weird about this Iron Heinrich. But
before we go into the interpretation, I'm just trying to remember how it went. It was...
His master
was released from the curse and his heart was so full that it burst the iron around his heart. Am I remembering that correctly?
No. Faithful Henry, in this one it's Henry, had suffered such care and pain when his master was turned into a frog that he had been obliged to wear 3 iron bands over his heart to keep it from breaking with trouble and anxiety. So they're riding along on this carriage and there's a big ass pop.
It's like one
and
bang as each...
Yeah, there's a bang. The prince looks back from the carriage and he's like, Heinrich, has the wheel burst? And he goes, no, it was the iron band that was laced around my heart. I had 3 iron bands placed around my heart when you were turned into a frog by the Wicked Witch for no explicable reason in this version. And twice more it happens. There's a bang and he goes, Heinrich, I think that, you know, the wheel is breaking. And he goes, no, I'm just happy that you're released from your curse. So my heart has grown in size like the Grinch 3 times that day. Yeah. And the iron band pop off. But the thing that really struck out on this rereading was that it goes, they kept riding along as if the wheel was breaking, but it was the breaking off of the other bands from Faithful Henry's heart because he was so relieved and happy at the end. And it doesn't go that the prince and the princess lived happily ever after. It introduces, in this version, Faithful Henry, and he lives happily ever after because his master was saved.
It is a very bizarre ending. Okay, so I did remember it correctly.
Yeah.
But I think the whole thing that differs, and I think maybe the reason why they, instead of having him kiss her, and then that's how he changed into a prince when she kisses him, in that version, she throws him against the wall instead of taking him to bed with her. Maybe it's kind of like a message that, well, especially for back then, like being chaste as a woman before you get married. Maybe it's like a symbol for that. I don't know. That's my guess.
Yeah.
Well, first she brings him to bed and she puts him on the silken pillow. Do you have a silken pillow? Of course I do. They go to sleep.
I felt dirty how much she enjoyed that silken pillow.
His little tushy. My little froggy tushy.
Dude, the same way that she was moaning when he went down her well to get the golden ball.
Yeah, exactly.
It's intentional. It's there.
Oh, nothing a Python member does is unintentional. If you thought something had a double entendre, you read it right.
Yeah.
And she wakes up and there's a very believable scorpion puppet.
Yeah, I wrote that. I'm convincing scorpion. Jim Henson would roll in his grave. He was still alive. But anyway, scorpion come from? What the? It seemed so random. Honestly, I was going, why scorpion? Where'd he get the flag and where'd he get the sword?
The flag.
those were my questions.
Or something, right?
And it's like a sword. Toothpick or something, right? He's a random frog.
It's like a hope.
And he's doing a bullfight. What the? Are scorpions attracted to the
That's the little handkerchief that he gets. The little red handkerchief is his thing that covers his nonsense later.
Oh, no, I know why he has it later, but where'd he get it in the first place?
Because he needed it to cover it for a family program.
So, of course, we have this little moment. It's cute. I like the little duel between him and the scorpion. I just think that Shelley or whoever was on the production set was like, we found this little scorpion puppet. Let's find a way to incorporate it. And they did. That's what I think.
Stupid little scorpion.
I did make a note about the synth right there. Yeah, it did a little like hero theme on this like very synthesized 80s thing. Yeah, and it was
this,
great.
According to the logic of our episode, this is what made the princess fall for him, that he stabbed a puppet.
He won her over.
And she's like, oh, okay, you saved me. Yay, Froggy, yay. And she's clapping. And then she's like, you know what? I guess I will. I'll kiss you. Sounds good. It's for that. You saved my life from the scorpion.
And we get even more cheesy 80s special effects.
Needed that.
Oh my God, you're a man.
Well, actually, I'm more than a man. I'm a prince. I'm Hal's elder brother.
Good grief.
You catch this? They played the love theme from Romeo and Juliet as he turns.
No, I did not. Frog.
Yes, they did. That's the love theme.
Well, he has the sparkly TV static on him to make him grow.
Yeah.
And of course, he's naked because Frog was wearing no clothes.
Hang on. His little red flag that he used to fight the scorpion is...
His little bullfighting flag. Yeah. Yeah, very convenient.
Also conveniently expanded when he expanded. I mean, that was very PG.
Talk about double entendre.
I think we are coming into the funniest in the entire episode, possibly the entire series. And Leon, this is where I'm going to cede to you because I know this scene means a lot.
This was formative. It essentially boils down into a sex comedy. So he's turned from a frog into a human with this little red thing.
Strategically placed.
Yeah, very strategically.
The princess is not at all upset by this.
Explains about his fairy godmother.
I have this eccentric fairy godmother, and well, Mom and Pops forgot to invite her to the christening, and wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, she turned me into a frog.
How awful.
Well, yes. And I can only be turned back into a prince by a kiss from a true princess. And that must be you. You are heaven sent. Thank you.
Well, how amazing.
Yes. Isn't that something?
Well, we have to get you out of here. If they find you in here, they'll kill you.
Well, can't we just tell them the truth?
Well, who would believe it?
Yes, I guess you're right. Mm-hmm.
It was hilarious. And that's, of course, when her father knocks on the door. It's kind of ridiculous when you think about it, because why is her father pounding down her door right at that moment? He's like, what was that noise? I'm like, what noise did they make? They were actually quite quiet.
Just like in the fairy tale, it's all in the subtext.
What was all that noise?
What noise?
Where's the frog?
What frog? Oh, the frog! He left.
How?
Out the window.
Whoa!
Over here.
Did you throw him out?
Why, no.
And he suspects that she killed the frog, which, when you know the original story...
You murderous little princess.
It makes a lot of sense when you know the original story. He's not far off.
That's another thing that I never really picked up on before, is that it does pay tribute to that original ending. Like, it never occurred to me. Yeah, pretty good.
And he's about to basically strike his daughter. I don't know how else to interpret that scene, but Robin Williams stands in.
No!
Who said that?
I did.
Well, you're not going to believe...
No, it's about, not as bad as it looks.
You're never going to believe this, Father.
Who is that?
He is the frog.
Yeah, pull the other one. How long has this been going on?
But you don't understand.
What's your name?
Prince Robin.
Yeah, Prince Robin. There is no such prince. Do you know what the penalty is for being caught in a princess's bed?
It's one of the best moments of fairy tale theater ever.
I know it.
I was going, why doesn't her father believe her?
Really? Is that what you were thinking as a kid?
As a kid, I'm like, well, she kissed him and he turned into a prince. Why doesn't her father believe that? Why is he so suspicious? All right. I was like six.
I was like 6 and I was over here thinking, why isn't there a naked man in my bed?
Well, that's something. The scene ends right there.
The king doesn't fall for the he's the frog. The king apparently came to the conclusion she threw the frog out the window and the prince was her secret lover. Got no idea where he came up with that, except that every other father on the planet would come to that conclusion.
As an adult, it seems perfectly logical, but as a kid, I was still thinking like, oh, why can't I?
Yeah, as a kid, I'm like, why wasn't he a believer? And then we cut to the king. He's in kind of a drunken stupor, and of all...
He sent her to a nunnery like a pregnant teen.
Oh, no, it's one of my favorite lines. Actually, it's probably my favorite line of the entire episode.
Really?
The princess was sent off to a very strict boarding school, where she was forced to learn Latin and play hockey.
Sounds terrible.
It does. It really does. It does. I mean, I can't think of anything worse, can you?
No.
And then, of course, we have the very pivotal moment where the king is sitting there drunk and very upset, and he became like an alcoholic, I guess, because he's so upset about what happened to his daughter.
Sells it. He just goes, what?
And he's just sipping from the bottle.
Yeah, he has the hand gesture.
Yeah, and the gold ball happens to be there. And
Griselda shows up in the ball. She's fabulous again. She croaks a little bit and shows off her double chin.
Tells the whole story, same as I've told it to you.
Yeah, so Griselda tells him the whole story of the Frog Prince and what happened and everything. And the king understands what happened and that his daughter was telling the truth. And that really was the frog. The frog was the prince. And that was who was in the bed. And
yes, that was on moral grounds. They must marry at once. And the final scene is them all posing. It's a wedding painting, not a photo, but a painting.
It was a VHS cover.
And it's a beautiful shot with the Maxfield Parish setting. Yeah. And
in the backdrop, they show Griselda again in the ball.
The very last of her frog tricks.
Yes.
Yeah, and yeah. She does like a gesture like she's been naughty.
And
like
then we get the theme, the fairy tale theater theme. That served on several of our episodes. What did we all take away from this episode? Leon, I'm actually going to start with you.
This is probably the moment when I was a little kid that I realized that I was gay. And you know how the guy transforms into the prince at the end and he's naked in the princess's bed and the guy comes banging on the door. Yeah, it developmentally, it had an effect in that I had never thought before. And I didn't mind when he turned back into a human. I was right along with her in this adaptation. In the other ones, it wasn't as poignant, but I think the Eric Idle script is the best thing about it, and it gave it a little bit of poetry. It's a crude story, and the Eric Idle script gave it a little bit of poetry for that.
Beautifully said. I'll agree. I always thought it was kind of an awkward fairy tale, and that's why I think a lot of interpretations kind of merge it with Beauty and the Beast, where she has to kiss him to turn him into a prince. That's not what the German version was saying.
No, she did throw him against the fucking wall and try and flesh that shit out.
Yeah, I mean, it is really such an iconic episode. It is the one that played the most often on reruns when I was watching it.
Eric, is there anything that really you have as a big takeaway from this episode?
I just love everything about this episode. I think everything about it just works so well. Mm. And I love Terry Garr and Robin Williams. I love the way they play off each other. And
great chemistry.
Yeah, I think it's just everything works so well in it overall. And yeah. I mean, when I was a little kid, the only other thing I had seen Terry Garr in was Mr. Mom. That was my only other thing that I had as a reference.
Oh, it's brilliant.
And I knew her from Young Frankenstein. I knew her Knocker, you know, rolling the hay.
Oh, yeah. I'm a long time Terry Garr fan. I remember her from Oh God. I remember her from Young Frankenstein. Yeah. What is everyone's favorite favorite and least favorite things about this episode. And I know that might be a little difficult because this is probably one of the best, if not the best. I think it's probably the most universally acclaimed episodes of Fairy Tale Theater.
It's the most, it's arguably the most iconic, but if I would change something about it, I would take out maybe 5 seconds of shtick when they're like, we, why are you her queen, your majesty? Not that the performance was bad, but I found that a little bit trying.
I mean, he's making jokes about like the architecture. I'm like, all right, we're good.
Yeah, but like thinking that it's all matte paintings. We're only shown that sequence through matte paintings versus...
He goes on about the color and it's all a black and white matte painting. All the architecture. He's like, oh, stop here so I can admire the colors. And the matte painting is all black and white.
I didn't notice that.
I think my favorite thing about this episode is Eric Idle's script and direction and
the script. Yeah. The script is the best thing about it.
Upon rewatch, the art direction, all the Maxfield Parrish inspired. I've since seen several Maxfield Parrish paintings and murals. And this was a beautiful interpretation of his artwork. And
yeah.
I'd honestly forgotten the art direction until I watched it again today. Least favorite thing, I really could have done without the chef trying to rub him with garlic. And
I would argue that the only reason that you think it's bad is because Le Poisson is the same scene but better.
No, I disagree. I just think it really? Was a wrong scene. We all knew that the frog wasn't going to be killed, so it's not suspenseful.
So moving on, Emily, what would you rate this episode?
I guess I'll go with a 9. The scenes with the chef went too long. Yeah, I think I'm at a 9 out of 10 because this is almost an absolutely perfect episode. It's as close to perfect as there is. Yeah.
It is very close to perfect. I think I would also say it as like a, but the 9.5 that I would take back would be the we, why, or like your queen, her majesty, the mother. It's nothing about the performance of the, yeah, we talked about how the guy took up multiple roles and it's not about the performance. I don't know. It's just that type of thing. Or Robin Williams being carried in on the plate and doing the ad-libs and stuff. I would think that it's probably a 10 out of just because it is the fundamental one, you know?
I cannot argue that. Eric, what do you think?
I would say, yeah, I'm probably at a solid, like you, Emily, like a 9.5, because there are a few things that could have been cut down and some things that could definitely have been edited a little bit more. But overall, it's a pretty perfect episode. I would say it is in one of my top episodes, definitely my top 3.
Oh,
for sure.
Yeah. And when I say 9.5, it's me nitpicking because I don't have to dig to find things wrong with this episode. It's one of the perfect episodes we've done.
Well, speaking of digging.
Oh, no.
Let's do this. Okay. Oh, this is old school. Okay, let's do it.
This is old school from, I think you know this website, Emily. I think you're familiar. Snow White 158.tripod.com.
Not only am I aware of this, I guarantee you Leon remembers this website.
She wrote it, because she had this website up before anybody else did. And going back on it was
1996.
Yeah.
So, Eric, what thing from my past did you find to haunt me with?
So for this episode, you gave it 4 spinning stars.
Oh, that's so 4 stars out of 4. That's my highest.
4 out of 4. Yeah. No, but why 4 out of 4?
I'm sure Eric will be happy to read my review.
If you only see one episode of Fairy Tale Theater, see this one. The Frog Prince is the first and probably the best episode ever made. This adaptation is, in a word, charming. It profits greatly from the presence of comedic actor Eric Idle. Idle penned the teleplay, narrated and directed the whole production. Robin Williams steals the show completely as the cute little frog with a love for the spotlight. Terry Garr is having a ball as the spoiled princess. This is great fun from beginning to end. All the actors are comics, so that's always a plus to any production. It's delightful and can stand for the whole series. Well, that's what you had to say. You had quite a few good quotes.
The holds up.
The top quote, the one you put at the top, a cat can look at a king, so a frog can certainly look at a princess.
I only know that from Alice in Wonderland.
That's the lead quote you put for that. So,
you know, I think I stand behind all
of them. I think I do too.
Yeah, you should hear some of the ones Eric's drug up in our past episode.
I haven't revisited those in like,
what was I stuck up in the fucking dorm room? Was Kinski phase? Where did that come from?
Oh no, that's yeah, a
different but issue. This one I will stand behind. Yeah, I think that's true. If you only see one episode of Fairy Tale Theater, see Frog Prince, I think I do stand behind that.
I think I would agree with that. It is the most iconic.
And we all had to struggle to find flaws in it.
But that's it. We just were able to nitpick at little things here and there. And really, it's just a great episode. It's solid.
Overall, yeah.
Yeah, I would say overall, I think all three of us agree. It's one of the most
phenomenal,
or maybe the definitive episode of the series.
Yeah. And revisiting it, I was anticipating them performing this silly script, and it did not disappoint.
I completely agree. It holds up. Thank you, everyone. This has been a delight. Leon, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's been great to have you.
Thank you for having me. It's an absolute pleasure. Fucking delightful as always, Emily.
And bossy as always.
Yes.
Right. That's true.
So thank you, dear listeners, for joining us for tonight's tale. I hope you will join us next time for Goldilocks and the Three Bears. Until then, remember to live happily ever after. Good night.
Thank you. Good night.